both off last night. Tonight, the Bucks play in New Orleans. The Bulls are home against Utah. NHL, the Blackhawks beat Florida 3-2 in overtime. They're off tonight. In the NFL, Aaron Rodgers says he's been medically cleared to play on Sunday. It's not clear whether he actually will play on Sunday. Also, kicker Ryan Longwell and tackle Mark Tauscher will be inducted into the Green Bay Packers Hall of Fame next July. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday, December 13th. Cloudy and seasonal. We'll see a rain-snow mix today, possibly 2 inches of accumulation, a high of 33. Tonight, then, cloudy and cold, maybe another inch of snow, a low of 17. Tomorrow, Thursday, partly sunny and cold, scattered flurries. Tomorrow's high, 26. Right now, wind from the south at 13, 28 degrees in Racine, 25 in Kenosha, wind chill, 13. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have in hand an exceptionally fascinating and potentially important book called The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. It is really a demonstrable fact that human beings seem to be the only creatures on Earth that seek out the meaning of life, that seem to have the capacity for and also the need to develop an understanding of meaning and purpose. Why are we here? How can we best function and flourish with one another? Not that that capacity has necessarily led to a human history full of love and compassion and kindness and mutual coexistence. We also, of course, look back at human history and see all kinds of horrors and missteps and mistakes. One of the purposes of this book by Jeremy Lent is to help us better understand how we got here, how history evolves. And the fact that history may evolve in some respects much more from our values and who we are and what we feel, how we see the world, how we see each other, something which Jeremy Lent calls cognitive history and understanding the development of history through the lens of the cognitive sciences. And one of the main points of Jeremy Lent's book is to help us maybe define and polish and deepen our understanding of how we are, who we are, and how that might spell the difference between ultimate catastrophe and the end of the human race versus finding our way forward to a brighter future in which we find a way to safely coexist on this fragile planet Earth. If that sounds like a lot to talk about, it is. But this is an important book, and I'm glad we can have the opportunity to speak about this. The author, Jeremy Lent, was formerly founder, CEO, and chairman of a publicly traded internet company. He is now a writer and founder and president of a nonprofit group called the Liology Institute, which is interested more than anything in trying to develop a worldview that will allow human survival. Again, this book is titled The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. The book is published by Prometheus Books. And Jeremy Lent, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how does one make the leap from what you did before in terms of founding and leading an internet company to creating this thing called the Liology Institute, concerned with the future of the planet and the future of the human race? Can you trace that journey, please?
Yeah, well, that is a great question. And I did, as you say, I spent early part of my life in business and founding a company, taking it public. And then I went through a part of my life when essentially things crashed around me. My wife at the time, who since passed away, got seriously sick. I left the company to look after her, but I left it really when it was still too early, and then the company itself collapsed after some time. And it felt like the things that I'd built around my life, the values I'd based it on, were sort of crashing around me. And I realized I had this opportunity to make my life move in the direction that I could choose, but I wanted it to be truly meaningful. So I started my own search for meaning, if you will. And I wanted to not just accept the received ideas I was told, but try to understand where they came from. That led me into this journey of realizing that these weren't just a matter of my own search for what was valuable, but as you were mentioning, the values that we choose end up, as a society, creating the direction of our society, ultimately the direction of history. So as I started to basically piece these together over years of research, I realized, well, you know, it would be great if there was a book that helped to kind of explore where all these things came from. So I ended up deciding to write the book myself for other people like me who were curious about making sense of all this.
Hmm. So let's try to sort out a couple of matters. And one of them, first of all, is to maybe have you help us understand this notion of cognitive science and understanding our history through that lens of cognitive science. Draw the contrast for us between this way of understanding history and what have been more predominant means of understanding history.
Yeah, sure. So in recent decades, the predominant way of making sense of sort of the big picture of history has been what's called geographic determinism. Which basically says that, you know, the way history evolves was ultimately not to do with differences between peoples, but to do with the geography. It just so happened that Eurasia was conducive to where civilization first evolved, or it just so happened Europe was closer to the Americas, so that's why Europe ended up being the ones who conquered the Americas, things like that. And that in itself was a great step forward from the older sort of 19th century inspired kind of thinking, which used to see history as the great rise of European values, which really was tinged with a lot of racism and the sense of sort of white supremacy ultimately. So that was a great step forward. But what it's tended to do is ignore the impact that culture has also had on history. And what this book does is it tries to sort of rebalance things a little bit. And it looks at ultimately questions, well, why was it Europe, not China, for example, that ended up conquering vast amounts of the world and dominating it with our present global civilization? Why did these things happen? And what I've really identified was that culture and the values that societies choose actually are big drivers of history. And that's not to say that European values are therefore better because it led to this domination of the world. But rather than attack those values or say how great they are, the book tries to kind of look at them and look at both the good and bad implications that have risen from that.
I think at this point it's important to gain some clarification on sort of the divisions of cultural difference that we are talking about. And the reason I posed this question is because as I was first exploring the book and kind of seeing where you were going, I realized that that, in a sense, one way that one might think about this is that, simplistically, all of us are mostly the same. Every human being who lives on the planet Earth, we're mostly all the same. We're mostly driven by the same things. We mostly care about the same fundamental human things. And of course, that can easily become this beautiful picture of a global family in which hopefully we can all learn to hold hands and work together and so on. And of course, you call that into question, because when I say that, when I describe the world in that way, I'm describing the whole world and everybody on it wanting the same things that I want, that it's my understanding, a Western-based understanding, and that I am thinking that every human being wants the same basic things that I want, or sees the world basically in the way that, that I do. On the other hand, if we start raising the possibility that different peoples in different places around the globe might be fundamentally different from me in terms of what they want, in terms of how they see the world, it sort of threatens that global family picture that many of us have constructed, however maybe erroneously that has been constructed. And so as I was reading that, I could just, I felt this mounting sense of concern about the potential ramifications of viewing the world, in a sense, in more divided fashion along cultural lines, not trying to blur those distinctions, but seeing them clearly. Can you talk a moment about the, in a sense, the potential risk that presents, or the way in which that might feel a little threatening to some people's global view?
Yeah, that's an interesting question you raise, Greg. And I would want to say, just for clarification, that, you know, I personally believe, and I think that science tells us too, that ultimately we humans, at the deepest levels, we are the same. And we are connected. We're deeply connected genetically. And in fact, all these distinctions that we're told about race, these are themselves just cultural constructs. The idea of race itself is not even a biological fact. It's just a made up fiction. And we share the desire to flourish. We share the need to live in community. There's a ton that we do share, and I think that it's important that we understand really ourselves in humanity as really a whole family. But then within that family, what happens is that the culture that we live in, right from the very earliest months of our lives, tends to produce different value systems, different ways of making sense of the world, that as we grow older and we become sort of more conscious, they become embedded in us, so much so that we're not even aware sometimes of the distinctions we make. And so it's at that sort of next level up that it's false to assume that we're all the same. For example, you know, the general notion we have in the West is that, you know, we're told that sort of exploiting the world is good, and that humans are fundamentally greedy, and we're told these things about what are the norms that turn out to be really cultural constructions of ideas that began in Europe and have now since sort of spread throughout the world, but are not necessarily reflective of humans. And in fact, and some fairly recently, some psychologists have developed what they call an analysis that shows that Western educated people tend to be the minority in the world, and they actually have a different ways of approaching things and different values that make them very different from how most people look at things. And yet most psychology experiments usually like students from Western universities, and then come up with universal predictions about humanity, which are just basically flawed. So that's the kind of way in which we have to be aware that we can't just take our Western ideas and assume that they apply to all of history and all other peoples.
Right. And so we need to be careful about those assumptions that we make. And I think the other thing is, I think when somebody just, again, first begins to read your book, I mean, that's what I was trying to highlight, was just the most initial impressions as I first got into the book, that that one might leap to certain erroneous conclusions about where you're going. And I suppose one of the questions here, too, is when we're talking about differences between various people according to culture, that one could break those down into very small chunks. And I think you are, at least for the most part, looking at that in a broader sense of East versus West. Am I right about that?
Yes. I do think that that's a good distinction to make, and that is right. And, you know, I think the best way we can get at what are these distinctions and what do we mean when we say that sort of values that we take in the West for granted are not applicable universally is this example I give in the book of back in the 15th century, this distinction between two explorers. One that we all know very well, his name is Christopher Columbus, discovered the New World. And the other was a Chinese admiral called Admiral Zheng. And I think that if we look at this contrast, we get to see the difference between values that we've just come to take for granted in the West and different ways that you can see the world. So when Columbus discovered the Indies in 1492, he was overcome by the ability of Western European strength to exploit this. You know, he wrote back to Ferdinand and Isabella, King and Queen of Spain. He would say, like, wow, you know, with just 50 soldiers, we could conquer this whole group of people in this island and take them back and use them as slaves in Spain. And what ensued was hundreds of years of basically conquest, domination, and taking over of the whole of the Americas by the Europeans. And we've come to accept sort of, well, that's kind of what you do. That's the only reason Europe did that is they have to get there first. But that same century, Admiral Zheng was this Chinese admiral who had a fleet of hundreds of boats that were literally like hundreds of times more powerful than Columbus's three little boats. And he used this fleet to go all over the Indian Ocean, Africa, Arabia, India, you name it. And he could have, if he'd wanted to, if he'd taken that approach of exploitation, created this massive Chinese empire, had like, you know, a massive slave trade, mined all the mineral wealth. He didn't do anything like that. It never even occurred to him. Instead, and he would actually look at who was the prince of a particular territory and invite them back to China to sort of kowtow to the emperor and start trade relations with China. And that kind of shows the way in which the exploitation that Europe applied to the rest of the world and that we still apply today to the natural resources of the world are not a sort of a human norm. They're actually uniquely arising from European values.
And I think part of the point of your book is that it was not just some accident of geography or geographic proximity that led to that, but in a sense, something deeper.
Yes, that is right. And that's actually a key difference between my approach to global history and the approach taken by many modern historians who actually look at geography as being the driver. And they essentially say, because they start off this assumption that we all share the same values. And so if the Chinese had gotten to America first, then America would be, you know, actually the United States of Jung or whatever you'd call it, rather than what it is today. And I basically make the case that that is a false way of looking at things, that the Chinese would never have dreamed to do to the Americas what the Europeans did. And in fact, you can actually see this clash of cultures. When the Europeans first sent their missionaries to China, they were amazed that the Chinese didn't even exploit their own gold and silver resources. There's this great journal entry that I quote in my book of a Jesuit missionary writing in the 17th century who's like, he says, you know, the hills out there outside of the town are filled with gold and silver. But the strange thing is the Chinese don't exploit them fully. And when I've asked them why, they say, well, to do that would cause imbalances and would make the people then, you know, not focus their attention on agriculture. And it would sort of create this kind of disharmony. So they're not exploiting them to the max. And he was just so puzzled. And it kind of goes to show this difference where one society, like our European-based values, focus on this notion of exploitation, disruption in order to gain power, whereas traditional Asian and Chinese values focus on the sense of balance, on harmony, and on everything sort of residing connected with other things in the world, and that the best way to live your life is to be in harmony with all things around you.
As you describe that, I'm wondering about something you said earlier in the interview when you talked about discussing this in a sense without passing judgment. I mean, that the point is not to say this way of understanding things is good and this understanding over here is bad. And yet, as the way you have just described these two perspectives or cultures, it sounds a little bit like the one is couched in fairly negative terms and the other in very positive terms. Is it just because it's hard to talk about them in any other way, or ultimately is there a bit of value judgment going on here?
That's a great question, Greg. Thank you for asking that. And so the reason why it's not really a positive or negative type thing is that same Western mindset was also what led to the scientific revolution. It led to all of the wonders of technology, all the ways in which our world today is so much more effective than it's been in past times, whether it's antibiotics, the internet, our ability to talk right now, even if we're thousands of miles away from each other. So many different things that we take for granted and that we all love came from that same Western approach to the world of looking at nature as a machine and understanding it and trying to essentially conquer nature was the sort of worldview. So that's why both good and bad things came out of this uniquely Western way of making sense of the world. But the reason that I actually and sort of couch a lot of it right now in negative terms is as we look at the world right now, we see some of the great imbalances that have risen from this mindset. We see the most extreme inequality that the world has ever seen, where you have a recent Oxfam report showed that the six wealthiest men right now own as much wealth as the entire lower half of the world's population. Unbelievable inequality. And we also see ourselves using the Earth's resources at such an unsustainable rate that we really can't continue to grow this global civilization for very much longer without facing the possibility of actually imminent collapse. And the reason for this unsustainable trajectory can be identified in that same mindset that led to some of these great developments of our modern civilization, which obviously leads us to ask, well, you know, what can we do about it? And in the book, ultimately what I suggest is that we can learn things from this other kind of worldview, this Asian worldview that looks at harmony and balance as being values in themselves. And is there a way that going forward in the world, we can continue with all the benefits that we've gotten from this scientific way of looking at the world, from this value of technology, and also learn to apply values of harmony and connection rather than exploitation.
Right. Just in the interest of fairness and balance here, I wonder if you can take the Eastern system of values, which you were just describing again in very positive terms and understandably so about balance and harmony and our connectedness with one another and so on. Just as there is a positive side to the sort of negative characterization of the Western values we were talking about before, is there a flip side to the Eastern system of values that of which we should be aware, or what are the ways in which this has manifested itself in more negative ways, or do you see it as for the most part entirely positive?
I think these are great points to explore, and you know there's a lot that can be viewed negatively when we look at East Asian and Chinese civilization. For starters, and just like other civilizations in history, and it was incredibly patriarchal, and it absolutely supported huge inequalities between the wealthy and the peasants. And even though they talked about harmony with nature, and they ended up in China creating some of the greatest environmental catastrophes that history has seen. You know, when they built the Great Wall of China to keep out the barbarians, they ended up causing massive deforestation, leading to incredible floods in their rivers. And so the point is that China is not exactly a paragon of, you know, how civilization can work effectively and well. And so that's one thing to look at really seriously. Another is a lot of people have viewed Chinese civilization very negatively in terms of it being bureaucratic and filled with stagnation. So for a lot of centuries, basically, when historians compared China to the West, they saw the West as being kind of vibrant and, you know, coming up with all these great new ideas, and Chinese civilization as being one of stagnation. So really what I'm trying to do in this book is more like try to get things rebalanced a little bit and try to point out that there are positives that we can look at from some of those values, but it's not all sort of good in one direction and bad in the other. And I'm glad you raised that question, Greg. Thank you.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jeremy Lent and talking about his very intriguing book called The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. In some ways, we're a little bit past this already, but I think it's a point maybe worth exploring, and maybe in light of the things we've just been talking about, it might be even easier to come to an understanding of this. Very early in the book, and I'm trying to remember if it's even in your foreword or the preface, but a point is made about how cognitive science, among other things, overcomes what was a long-standing division between mind and matter. And first of all, say a word about that division, where it essentially came from, why was that constructed in the first place, and what is the problem with that? What ways is our sort of our comprehensive understanding of ourselves compromised if it starts from such a perspective of a sharp division between mind and matter?
Yeah, and these are deep questions that I explore in the book. And, you know, it sounds at first like, well, this is so philosophical. How does this even matter in our real life? But it turns out that these actually do affect the way that most of us make sense of the world. And so this kind of split between mind and matter is, again, something that is unique to Western thought. And it started with the ancient Greeks, who were the first to come up with what I call like a dualistic conception of the universe. So they saw humans as being composed of two different qualities, if you will. One was this kind of eternal soul, and one was the body. And they saw the soul as being almost like imprisoned, essentially, in the body. And they saw the universe the same way, that you had the universe being the material world, and Plato was the one who did the best job of giving this sense of a sort of a transcendent world that was eternal and where the good really came from. So there was this kind of split cosmos and a split human being. And that's actually what Christianity is founded on, is this notion of you have God out there in one dimension and the world here is in another dimension, and the humans themselves are composed of the soul that goes to heaven and the body that just dies. So this is fundamental to the way in which we make sense of the world. And it's not just a sort of old-fashioned thinking, because starting with Descartes in the 17th century, this notion of the soul really got transformed into this idea of the mind. So we have this mind-body split that most of us take for granted, which again is actually a construction of Western thought. So that if we look, for example, at East Asian ways of making sense of the world, they don't see the split. They actually see the mind as, in fact, they use the word mind as heart. So they see the mind as actually existing in the heart rather than just in the brain, the way we see it, which leads to very different ways of looking at things like the split between reason and emotion. And so these have huge ramifications for the ways in which we make sense of our lives and our values.
And I think what you're, one of the things you're saying here is that there is something limiting about that split if we operate from that assumption of there being a sharp split or sharp distinction. In what way is that limiting? Or, I mean, in what way is that a problem?
Yeah, so the way in which it becomes a problem is that in Western thought, we tend to see the human being is almost like this battleground between the mind and the body, or between like the will and what our sort of our emotional drives are. And we see this in so much thinking, all the way from St. Paul, who thousands of years ago started with this notion of he saw himself as this battleground between good and evil. And you have Freud, who sees the human as a battleground between the sort of ego and the superego and the id. And you even see that in, strangely enough, you see it even in the most modern thinkers. There's a technology guru, if you will, whose name is Raymond Kurzweil, who talked about how as technology develops, he'll be able to download his mind. And so he thinks that just a couple of decades from now, technology will be so advanced, you'll be able to upload every sort of neuron in your brain to a computer, your body can die, and then you can sort of download it into a new body. So you have these strange myths that actually go all the way to the most modern ways of thinking, which are built on something that cognitive scientists now show is just completely false. They're actually, when we look at the brain and we look at how our consciousness works, there is no real clear distinction between emotions and our cognition. And in fact, the mind is not a computer. And the neurons themselves don't have sort of software and hardware. They're not broken down like that the way computers are. But the actual physical makeup of the neurons are themselves part of the information that they transmit across all the billions of synapses in the brain. So these distinctions are just sort of a construction of Western thought. And that leads to the like ineffective and kind of wrong ways of trying to allow ourselves to flourish.
We have at the heart of your book the exploration of some core patterns of meaning that have developed over time. And they are, of course, big topics. Ahead of that, you talk about kind of an interesting loop that probably most of us are completely unaware of. And that is, in a sense, the relationship between our own sort of cognitive selves, the way we feel and think and view the world and each other, and the events of history as they unfold. And you talk about how this is not a one-way street, one affecting the other, but it is a reciprocal relationship, one each affecting the other. Clarify that reciprocal loop that, as you tell us, most of us just don't think about and probably don't even easily comprehend.
Yes, you know, this does lead into some of the interesting weaves that we kind of explore through the book, is how basically it's not just a matter of, you know, we were talking earlier about the modern historians talk about geographic determinism, talking about how geography and the physical stuff around us affects how we act. And in the book, I also look at how our ideas and our values actually affect our society. But where it gets really complicated is when you realize that these two things kind of loop around together. So that there are some examples that evolutionary biologists look to. One fascinating example is that back thousands of years ago, when people first developed the ability to domesticate cattle, most grown adults back in those days were unable to tolerate lactose. And so once you were no longer a child, there was no value to having the milk that cattle would produce. But then a genetic change happened in certain places where, as people got to be grown-ups, they were still able to process the lactose, and that was really good for them because of all the protein. So that kind of genetic change actually spread throughout the population. So you have this example of how what we do culturally, like domesticate cattle, ends up actually leading to human evolution and changes in our genetic makeup. So that's a kind of example of how things can flow in different directions. Or another example of that is when we developed agriculture, at first it just kind of happened by accident, but then the fact of agriculture and being stuck in one place and growing crops led to all these new values that arose in our human experience that never existed for hunter-gatherers, ideas of property and possessions and inequalities and hierarchy and wealth and the patriarchy. All of these things came as a result of the development of agriculture. So it's fascinating how you can sort of follow these intertwining of these values and physical stuff that we do throughout history.
Right. It's important for us, I think, to understand that we're talking about a couple of different levels here, too. At one point, it's one of my favorite parts in the book, you talk about the way in which we tend to develop what I think you call our core metaphors or root metaphors, such as high is better than low and light is better than dark, or we think of life is a journey along a path, and that these kind of core points of understanding develop very, very early on, and often, I think, quite unconsciously. I mean, we don't consciously understand that we're taking on these assumptions, these core understandings, and probably even those who are raising children and guiding children maybe don't even realize as well that that's part of what they're doing here, is creating these core values.
Yes, that is so true. And, you know, I hope that one of the things that reading my book can catalyze is for readers to really look at that and ask themselves this question, what kind of values or what kind of ways of making sense of the world do I take for granted that I don't even think about? Because it turns out that each culture actually does have what you rightly describe as root metaphors, these core metaphors about humanity and our relationship with nature, that everything is sort of built on. But because they're so core, we sort of take them for granted. They sort of hide in plain sight. We don't even realize that we're making those assumptions.
Right. I mean, I think a typical parent is certainly understands that they're teaching their child you know, don't hit your sister, share your toys, it's important to eat, it's important to sleep. I mean, but those are not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about, in a sense, deeper values that are beyond, in a sense, kind of the everyday stuff of everyday life.
We are, you know, and I think one of the important things for us to note is that a lot of these values are inculcated through our culture without us even realizing it. So when, you know, we're talking about raising maybe our kids, and when those kids are sitting in front of TV and they're watching these messages coming at them, basically saying that consuming is good, and if you want something, you know, you should go out to the store and you should buy it, and if you have something better than your friend, then that makes you higher up in the status, and, you know, and that friend's going to want to consume more. There's these core underlying values of our society around consumption and exploitation and hierarchy and status coming from the sort of wealth that we're seen to have. These are values that don't get explicitly stated, but they're there in everything that we receive. So as we move into our teens and become adults, we just live our lives according to those without really sometimes actually questioning them.
Right. And your book, of course, is a careful, thorough exploration of all of this. And in particular, this distinction that I find so interesting between our conceptual consciousness and our animate consciousness.
Right. And that distinction kind of follows along with this, you know, we've talked before about this kind of dualistic split between reason and emotion. And in the West, what has tended to happen is that we've made this distinction between our conceptual consciousness and our ideas as being the mind, as existing completely separately from what I call our animate consciousness, which is what we share with basically all other mammals. And somehow that conceptual consciousness is what is good, and our animate consciousness is something that we should sort of raise above. But what we explore in the book is that a truly integrated human, and somebody who can really flourish the most, is one where we actually can give an equal value to both of those levels of relating to the world. So when my animate consciousness is the kind of thing that gives me my feelings and my drives, and it's important to recognize that it's not flourishing is not about like just transcending those or fighting them back, but about integrating them with my actual way of making sense of the world.
Mm. As you talk about some of these patterns on the most basic level, you really explore some fascinating questions, including the question of why is it that human beings have come to dominate the planet the way that we do, while other primates have not, and what sets us apart. And of course, it ultimately is things like the sophistication of our language or our ability to cooperate and not just compete with one another. Could you just speak briefly to those two really fundamental points about who we are?
Yes, and that's another area where modern findings have kind of overturned what has been understood in more sort of mainstream thinking over these last few decades. Because again, we're told that a lot of the time we're told that humans are fundamentally selfish. But and what cognitive anthropologists who have studied how humans first evolved, what if this determined is that actually our ability to connect together to work together in community is what makes us really uniquely different from other primates like chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans, etc. And that community instinct has given us things like more empathy and compassion and those kind of values of working together and something called shared intentionality. By working together, we can essentially create culture and make things happen. And that's the kind of thinking that gave us language and ultimately gave us the ability to dominate the world. And I do think that's so important because it also gives us a sense of hope for the future. Because if we can build our values now based on that recognition of our connection with each other, of our connection with the natural world, and it gives us the ability to develop a set of values that could be more sustainable than ones that just see us as, you know, each of us looking out for ourselves and exploiting the world in every which way we can.
Right. As you explore this whole question of what is ahead, you raise an important point, which is that even very, very wise people have not always been all that good at predicting the future, because the future tends to unfold in nonlinear fashion. And
right.
And so, of course, as we start thinking about where this planet is headed, right from the start, we need to be careful to make sure that we aren't thinking in simplistic terms, in terms that are entirely linear. There are reasons to think that we are on a steep slope towards catastrophe, but there is that's a rather simplistic view in some respects, and even granting more important points about our future, we need to remember that, to not be too simplistic.
Yes.
About the way we plot the way we're headed.
I think that's so true, Greg, and I do think that that non-linear direction of history is, in a way, is both the greatest threat to future human flourishing and our greatest opportunity. So, you know, it's a threat in the sense that, you know, right now when people point out that our way of consuming the earth is unsustainable, a lot of sort of optimists, techno-utopians or whatever will say, oh, they've been saying that for decades, and look, the world just gets richer and richer, and we keep getting more and more advanced, and so, you know, we can just keep doing this indefinitely. So, of course, that assumes a linear direction to history, but the non-linearity is that, you know, we can actually just keep thinking we're doing better and better and better until we hit the precipice and then collapse. So that's the scary part. But the hopeful part is that oftentimes it's easy to, if we do care about future human flourishing, it's easy to get a sense of despair when we see this kind of gigantic transnational corporations just essentially consuming more and more, dominating the media. And those of us who actually want to see the world get to be a better place can easily go, well, we're just totally going in the wrong direction. But that's where the nonlinear aspect of history can really be a source of hope. And we can see that just in right here in today's world right now, where we saw the Time Persons of the Year were the people who spoke out, for example, on the Me Too movement. And that's a perfect example of how history can work in a nonlinear way. This notion of, you know, the kind of patriarchy where men can basically treat women in these ways that have been done for almost like throughout history. People might say, well, yeah, they're never going to get their comeuppance. Then all of a sudden, something shifts, and suddenly things, the whole power dynamic can look very different than it did before. And when that happens, it can happen far more rapidly than anybody can predict.
And one can hope that some of that will flow in positive directions. We should say that your book in this final section explores all kinds of fascinating specifics, including what some possible scenarios are for the future of our own society. Are we destined to collapse the way the Roman Empire collapsed? Or what are some of the other forces at work that could ultimately end society as we know it? And you explore all kinds of different pathways that potentially could be ahead for us. In the last minute or so, it sounds as though you are guardedly hopeful. Is it fair to say that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do have hope, but I do have think there's a distinction between hope and optimism, in the sense that even if you feel pessimistic about where some things are going, hope is a different kind of thing. Hope is like a state of mind, and it's a way of looking at the world and saying, you know, the things that we'll do really can make a difference. And so even if things look pretty grim as we see some of the developments out there, the simple fact of that non-linear nature of history gives us a reason to really want to devote ourselves and recognize that we actually, what each of us does can make a difference in how the future unfolds. And that's where my sense of hope comes from.
Well, we have just skimmed the surface of your massive and fascinating book, which again is called The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. The book is published by Prometheus. The author, Jeremy Lent. Jeremy Lent, this was quite an interesting journey for me, exploring your book and then having the chance to speak with you about it. I thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be on the show and a pleasure to talk with you, Greg. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Nan Calvert will be joining us, and with her will be Todd Brennan, who is the Watershed Project Manager for the Alliance for the Great Lakes. I look forward to that conversation very, very much. Friday's Morning Show, in part, will include a conversation about this weekend's Sing-Along Messiah at First United Methodist Church I will be speaking with Jessica DeBoer, who is coordinator for the Fine Arts at First series. The Sing Along Messiah, Sunday evening at 6 p.m., will feature full orchestra and array of soloists, as well as the participation of Imuzici and the Lincoln Chamber Singers from Carthage, with yours truly on the podium.